ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 has flown round the moon, and the four astronauts on board are on their way home.
Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier.
We're following every step of the mission in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Stay with us as the mission continues to unfold, with updates from me, Belinda Smith, so you know what just happened and why it matters.
Integrity, over to you.
Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Damien Carrick, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Every time you reach into your pocket and check your smartphone, you're not just snapping a picture, taking a call, or using an app. You're also tapping into a data centre. They're one of the unseen engines powering our modern life. The rate that AI is being adopted means a lot more data centres need to be built to keep up with demand. But as they pop up in neighbourhoods around the country, we're going to take a look at the real cost to the hosting communities. And the Artemis 2 crew have travelled further from Earth than any humans before them. A huge moment for space exploration, and yet, if I'm being completely honest, I know it's a big deal, but I'm not entirely sure why. So what exactly can Artemis mission teach us back here on Earth? But first, you never get married thinking it's going to end in divorce, and you never have kids thinking that one day they'll live across two separate houses, under two different roofs, in two different bedrooms, with two different sets of rules around how to stack that dishwasher. But life happens. Things don't always go to plan. And if you thought finding one house to fit the needs of your family was stressful enough, now you have to find and build two. And running alongside all those logistics is something heavier. It's guilt. The notion that if the world of your kids has to change, you as parents have to compensate. So you stretch yourself. You stretch yourself financially, emotionally, trying to give them everything in both places. Well, I want to lift some of that guilt off your shoulders this morning, because while there's no doubt this is difficult emotional terrain to navigate, as long as kids have a sense of safety and security, the bells and whistles of the house they live in are not, or less important perhaps. That's what new research from the Australian Institute of Family Studies shows, and you're going to hear about that in a tick. But first, I want to know how you did this. If you and your partner have separated, what did the home look like for your kids? Were there two separate dwellings? Or did the kids stay in the family home with the parents alternating, moving in and out to share care? Or if you're a child of divorced parents, how did your parents do it? How did they create a sense of home in the midst of this big adjustment? Mandy Nolan is a comedian based in northern New South Wales and a former host of The Split, a podcast about life after divorce. Mandy, welcome to Life Matters. Tell me about your family. What did it look like in the months leading up to your separation?
Oh, hello. This was some years ago, but the months leading up to were really tough. And, you know, I was really unhappy in the relationship, and I think my partner was really unhappy too, but he probably would have gone on for another 20 years like that, quite possibly. But it was, I think it was really tense, and I only realised it was tense for the kids now, kind of as well as me looking back. So those moments too went, I mean, that conversation where you sit on the couch and go, it's kind of like this. It's like
the conversation before, with your partner or the conversation with your kids?
No, it was actually the conversation with my partner. He's quite a, he was like, okay, that's it then. Well, you can tell the kids. And I'm like, oh my God. So I had to sit them down. It happened really quickly.
And how did they react?
Oh, it was heartbreaking. My youngest son was about, he would have been about, probably 7 or 8. My other daughter was about 10 and the other one was about 13. And they just wept. They were so it was the most heartbreaking thing, because suddenly in one conversation, their life as they knew it changed completely. And lots of people said to me, it'll be better for the kids. And in that instance, it was really what I was making a decision about what was better for me. And I had a lot of guilt about that. And in the end, it's worked out. But I didn't let myself off the hook by going, oh, look, it's going to be better for the kids. This was complex, painful. And I had to kind of walk into the pain without, nothing could rationalize away, you know, how complex. It's hard.
It's complex,
I think it's one of the
right?
hardest moments. Yeah, really
so,
complex.
So emotionally complex. But what were the new living and care arrangements that you had to build in the midst of all this emotional complexity and you know, trauma? What did you build? What were those new care arrangements?
Well, one of the things my ex-husband and I did, which I think was a really important conversation. So whilst it was complex between us for some time, we centered the kids in all our decision making. So we decided to go 50-50. He moved out, and so he got another house. And then I had to try and maintain that I was renting. So suddenly I had to work out, how am I going to pay the rent on this house on my own? You know, though, it's suddenly your costs double, you know, and then you've got to duplicate everything for the kids. So if they're doing 50-50, you know, they have to, you know, half the things left their bedroom. So you have to get new beds, new mattresses, new things for their rooms. And then they travel with these little bags from house to house, which that's the most heartbreaking thing when you put your kid in a bag with a bag and they go to their other house. And often they don't have their favorite things there, like their favorite book, their favorite toys. And rather than taking them back and forward, it's a real opportunity to go, okay, what can I replace? What can I get something new? How do I build new traditions in? Because, you know, the kids shouldn't have to take their life, you know, from in a suitcase, you know, back and forth so much. So we tried to get double the uniforms, double everything. But of course, everything ends up at one house eventually. And then you have to reposition it back to the other house.
So a lot of logistics, double the shoes, double the uniforms, double the kind of welcoming kind of the bedroom space where you feel you belong. Kylie Butler is a researcher at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. She authored this paper into kids' sense of home after separation. Kylie, what do we know about how Australian families manage the care of their kids after separation?
So in recent years, we're seeing a bit of a shift where shared parenting arrangements are becoming more common. And that's like what Mandy's talking about, where kids will split their time more evenly between the homes of each of their parents. And this is a shift from previously, it would typically be the mother who was the primary carer and they would spend less time with their dad. So we're seeing a more even split of time. And this looks like a kid having two homes instead of one. And the idea of this is that it gives the kids the opportunity to maintain and build strong relationships with each parent and to essentially feel like they have two homes, two spaces where they belong.
So the idea now is that it's far more common for people to have two real homes or kids to have two real homes. So there's a need to either kind of replicate or maintain two kind of homes. What's the impact? We heard from Mandy that, you know, there was kind of a difficulty at the beginning, but kind of, you know, an amicable relationship between the parents. What's the impact of an amicable split on a kid's sense of home?
What the research is showing is that for situations where it's safe for the child to live with both parents, so, you know, situations where there's not family and domestic violence, and where there's, you know, if there can be a relatively low level of conflict between the parents, these kind of situations can have really positive outcomes for kids, because feeling that sense of belonging, that sense of ease and comfort in two places is really important to their well-being and maintaining those strong relationships with both parents.
Yeah, Mandy, how important was the relationship you maintained with your ex in helping the kids feel at home across these two different houses?
Oh, it's critical, because if you can't have conversations with the other parent in a reasonable way, you're not going to manage a 50-50 split, because what happens is the children become the message sticks, and that And if you've got a volatile relationship, they become weaponized. So we had to make sure that when we, you know, so it's like you've got to go, because, you know, the kids will try and pull a Swiftie on you, particularly when they're teenagers around, you know, going to a party or going somewhere. So you might have a rule at one house and they get to the other house. And sometimes you've got to accept the fact there might be a different rule at that house. Or how do you get that parent to go, how do we be on the same page? Not just about the rooms, but about the kind of family architecture of what's permissible and where the boundaries are, because that is actually part of safety as well. So we had to work to keep that in place. And I had to learn to compromise a lot of things that I might have put in place had we still been in a relationship, because my partner had different views, or my ex-partner had different views as a parent as well. So you actually continue to be in relationship with your ex in a different way. And when you center your children, you have to be mature enough, and this is in a safe relationship where there is no domestic violence, to move to this next level of how you can do it amicably. It doesn't mean there's not conflict, doesn't mean that you always agree. And it's definitely challenging. And you actually do learn and grow from it. And the kids, you know, as soon as I get annoyed about something, I just go, how do I stop the kids, you know, having to pay the price of our relationship failing? And it really helps refocus you into, you know, what's best for them. How do we have this complex conversation?
And I suppose what we're focusing today on the shape of the home in making sure that they have that, you know, a positive adjustment over time to when families split up. I'm Damien Carrick, and you're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Today, talking about creating a sense of home for your kids after separation. And I'm speaking with Mandy Nolan, comedian based in northern New South Wales, former host of The Split, a podcast about life after divorce, and also Kylie Butler, researcher at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. And I'm taking your calls this morning. I want to know how you did this when you and your partner separated. What did the home look like for your kids? Were there two separate dwellings, or did the kids stay in the family home with the parents alternating, you know, moving in and out of shared care? And if you're a child of divorced parents, how did your parents do it for you? How did they create a sense of home in the midst of this big adjustment? Kylie, how important is the physical house itself for a kid's sense of well-being after separation?
This was a really interesting thing that came out of the research, because parents will often, you know, feel a lot of guilt if they're moving to a smaller home or having to downsize. Whereas kids will put less focus on physical spaces and possessions. So those things can have importance. But what the research was really showing is that the things that are most important to creating a sense of home for children are the emotional connections they have with other people in the home. And it's often the small things, everyday routines, feeling that they're loved and cared for, that their parents are showing an interest in them, having a safe space to relax or retreat in. So these things can be much more important than the actual physical aspects of a home.
And what does the research say about how you can give your kids a sense of that safety and security in the home?
Part of it is involving children in decisions. So letting kids have a voice. Adults, often with the best of intentions, will make decisions for kids or assume that we know how they're feeling or what they're thinking. So this doesn't mean allowing kids to make all the decisions, but it does mean asking them what's important to them, what they're concerned about, what they would like things to look like, and then trying to build from there.
So you listen to them, see what they want, and then you try as best you can to accommodate that, right?
Where it's reasonable, obviously, and also just to work out, you know, what are their concerns, because they might be worried about things that you haven't thought of.
Yeah, right. Mm. Kylie, the research you reviewed spoke to many kids firsthand about what they felt after changing houses following separation. What did they say? What were the things that came to the attention of researchers when they thought maybe one thing was important, but in fact other things were important?
This resonates a lot with what Mandy was saying. Some of the things that kids struggled with were when there was conflict between parents that could make them feel anxious if they were moving between homes during the changeover. The packing of belongings going from place to place could be challenging. It kind of related to a sense of not feeling permanent at either location. So where it was possible, having multiple sets of whether it's clothes, books, favourite toys, where that's possible, that can help with some of that stability. But having routines, knowing what the routines are in each place, having a little pattern when you first go to one home or the other to settle in, and interactions, just basic everyday interactions. It could be things like cooking a meal together, walking the dog, in the garden, whatever a kid's interest is and what's age appropriate for them. Those small things were often more important than big events.
And how did the kids in the research navigate the changing dynamics across the homes? Did they try and, I mean, the relationship, how did they kind of use, when parents had these strategies, did that actually mean that the parents got on better and the kids got on better with the parents?
Yeah, overall it does. It helps kids build those strong relationships with their parents. But like Mandy was saying before, it can be very complicated. There's always going to be conflicts. Kids are going to, you know, try to push boundaries. There might be different rules in each house. So having clarity about what the boundaries are, what's appropriate in each home, keeping conversations open, checking in with kids, all those things can help.
Now, I've just got, I think we've got some texts rather than SMS, calls. So let me just read some of them. My teens have an ensuite at my ex's place, while we share only two rooms and a single bathroom at my rental. They're just as happy at either place. And though the money stuff is hard, I'm pleased to model frugality in our resource constrained world. That's Andrew. And also we've got Rachel says that the children should be able to stay in their home and the parents find their separate dwellings. That they should do all the coming and going. There is always a parent with the children for their contact, and not the children being bumped around every day, weekend. Children do not choose this situation, but they pay the price. And I'll just check across the glass with my producer. Are these people SMSing, or are they actually, we can talk to them direct? Yep, great. Okay, SMSing. And also Kim says, sharing kids after separation, my ex and I split time equally. May I suggest that the next step in the evolution of creating stability for kids during separation is for the kids to stay in the family home and each parent move out when it's not their turn with the kids? That's Kim from Woodbridge in Tasmania. Hey, Mandy, do all those kind of comments ring true to you?
Yeah, I understand the one they're talking about is what they actually call colloquially bird nesting. And that's all well and good if you own your home. You can't really bird nest in a rental because you get kicked out. Like nobody, you don't own that rental. So that's on the assumption, one, that parents actually get on well. And I know people that actually do that, and it does work up to a point. But sometimes people repartner, and that partner might have other children, and you might have another child. I ended up repartnering, got a stepchild, and had another baby. So that, you know, I ended up in a house where they all had a room each, and then suddenly everyone's sharing a room with one bathroom with five kids. Like that really brought us close together. And then we built a home. Yeah. And then, but, you know, and then they'd go to their dad's house and they're going, oh, we've got our own room. So they went from sharing a room at my house to actually having their own room somewhere else. I think there's no hard and fast rules for parents. And I think, and for kids, I think the really key thing is, rather than saying everyone has a solution that's going to work better for them according to their circumstances. And I think, as long as you center the kids and their well-being and talk with them along the way, you actually get better at doing it. And life changes. There are no guarantees. Nothing is forever. This whole idea that, you know, this sense we have of this attachment to permanence is actually one of the best things we can do for our kids, is teach them about impermanence and teach them about the need to be flexible, and that safety and security is something that comes from within, and within you, solid relationships that are safe and loving, not volatile, and that you can move house and still be happy and have a sense of safety and security. And you cannot have an ensuite, and you can actually still be happy. Unbelievable.
Life goes on.
Yeah, we built this big house and eventually and got all the kids into it. And they finally had all their own room, and we thought they'd come and sit on the couch, and they all just sat in their room on their social media. And my husband and I, just my new husband and I, knew of 17 years now, but we just sat on the couch and went, oh, it was so much better when we lived in a tiny rental with everyone sharing houses. Now they just avoid us. So sometimes more space and more affluence isn't great for connection.
Yeah. We've got Nola on the line. She's from Melbourne. Nola, take me back to the day you told your children you were separating. How did that conversation go?
Well, it was very interesting. My husband at the time, we prepared ourselves and gone to a psychologist and said, she said, you know, don't tell them at night, tell them in the morning, sit them down, blah, blah, blah. So that's what we did this particular morning. And we told them that we were going to separate. And my 8-year-old boy lay back on the bed and went, oh, no. And I was like devastated. And I thought, oh, gosh, what, darling? And he said, I don't know which house to have the Lego at and which one to have the Duplo at. And that sort of broke the ice so well for all of us. But anyway, we went on. We had two separate places. They were close by. That's really important to each other, the houses, in case you forget things. We had a half a week at a time. We shared them. Then we had a week at a time. And then they eventually chose where they wanted to live. But they were loved and cared about and secure. And they are two of the most stable 45-year-olds that I know.
Look, Nola, that's really, really interesting to hear that you kind of, you really sat down with your partner and kind of worked out a strategy together. And it sounds like you did that from the very beginning with that initial conversation, and you did it all the way through as your kids grew up. Look, Mandy, did you try and keep that kind of cooperation going with your partner, your ex-partner?
Oh, yeah, we'll have Christmases together. I try and engage a big, broad, blended family because, you know, if you can do that, I think it really helps. It helps teach the kids that, you know, just because you're not in a relationship with someone, you're still in a relationship. It's just that the terms of that relationship have changed. He's still their father. He's still someone I married and spent this time with. And that's actually really healthy. I actually think, in relationships, and I think it helps kids actually understand that too. And look, honestly, in their peer group, it's weird to have families that, like, they don't know many people who've got parents that have stayed together from the beginning to end, basically. It's quite normal to have other families that separate. So there isn't a stigma around that. It doesn't mean we're in a housing crisis. It's complex to keep two houses. It can set you back financially 10 years to have to replace everything and start from scratch. So let's not minimize how hard it is. Mm. And if you're already, you know, to suddenly go to being a single parent, that's tough, you know. So you do have to recognize that, you know, you're not in a better position financially, and it's a pretty tough world out there, but you can make it, you know, really good. We created our own new traditions in our family, and we started to make a story that was just ours.
Interesting. I understand that you used to kind of do a photo shoot every year but before Christmas, but after the split, you kind of morphed that into something different. What'd you do?
Well, because they had like a blended family eventually with I was a step parent as well as my partner was a step parent, and we had a new kid. We did one of those photo shoots, you know, where you're all wearing jeans and white shirts on the beach. And I just went, yuck, I hate that family. That's a lie. That's not who we are. And then I went, let's just do something that's really kind of, you know, more about us. So every year the kids got to choose a theme. Like some year it was zombies and some year it was, you know, Wizard of Oz or superheroes. And we'd all dress up and do this really weird photo. Like the photo shoots were funny. And then we'd make it our Christmas card and send it off. It was kind of a celebration.
Kylie, so, you know, wrapping up, you know, what can interrupt or challenge a child's sense of home with separated parents, and what can we do to make sure that you address those?
Yeah, so even in the, you know, best situations where parents are getting along well, kids have good relationships with both parents, it's still always going to be a complex, tricky time. There's a lot of changes in location, changes in family dynamics. When parents repartner and there's new people in the home, that can be challenging. So there's a lot of you know, different aspects to navigate along the way. And we've been talking a bit about flexibility and the need to, you know, adapt as time goes on. So I think it always goes back to what we were saying before about checking in with what kids need, with how they're feeling, with what works for your family. Talking about starting new family traditions is a great one that came up. A lot of things that kids will remember and that will be important to them.
Yeah, that's right. I think that idea that Mandy was going to talk about of creating new family traditions, not the kids in the white shirts on the beach, but you know, maybe kind of a horror themed family shoot. Something which kind of moves with the times. Look, great to talk to you. That's Kylie Butler, a researcher at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. And we also spoke before with Mandy Nolan, who unfortunately we lost on the line from regional New South Wales. She's a comedian based in northern New South Wales and the former host of The Split, a podcast about life after divorce. Now, in just a tick, how would you feel if a data centre popped up in your neighbourhood? And as the use of AI increases, a lot more data centres need to be built to keep up with demand. But what is actually the real cost?
On Radio National, we revisit history.
This woman would emerge with a legacy that would last centuries.
From unexpected events,
this is the beginning of the end.
To the deeper forces behind them.
Suddenly, 200 times as much could be made.
On Radio National, we revisit the turning points.
To the people assessing her, she's absolutely insane.
The past 250 years have seen an unprecedented surge in innovation.
The sliding door moments of history.
ABC Radio National.
Every time you reach into your pocket and check your smartphone, you're tapping into a data centre, one of the unseen engines powering our modern life. And right now, those engines are multiplying fast. As AI adoption surges, so too does the demand for data centres. There are already about 270 around the country, and many more are on the way. But they come with a catch. These facilities require enormous amounts of energy and water to operate. A New South Wales inquiry is now examining this rapid expansion, with three local councils pushing back amid concerns that some housing projects have been delayed due to water supply constraints. This technology isn't going anywhere, but how it fits into our infrastructure and what it means for our communities is becoming harder to ignore. Now, would you mind if a data centre was built in your suburb? I'd love to hear your opinion on this. You can text us on 0418 226 576. That's 0418 226 576. Dr. Aslan Gordon is a senior lecturer in sustainability and urban studies at RMIT. Aslan, what are data centres and why are they so necessary?
Yeah, hi, Damien. So data centres are sort of big facilities that house all the computing resources required to run the online services we use every day. So you can imagine them as like a large warehouse, often several stories high. And in that warehouse, there's corridors, and each corridor is just lined with hundreds of what we refer to as servers, which are basically just computers that manage and process all of the data we use for all the applications we use every day, such as sending emails, editing and sharing documents, video conferencing, streaming video and audio, which I'm assuming some listeners might be doing now, online banking. So all of these things are run by the computers housed in data centers. But as you mentioned, currently with this huge boom in the use of AI, that's also becoming a large proportion on what data centers are being used for as well.
So give me a sense, are they hundreds of meters long? Can they be, you know, a kilometer long? Can they be, what, a few stories high? How big are they?
Yeah, so currently data centres, you know, maybe some hundreds of metres long in Australia, and you know, 2 to 3 stories sometimes corridors with all of these servers mounted on them. But more and more, sort of Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and big companies like OpenAI are planning massive data centres that are going to be significantly larger than this as well. But we haven't seen any such huge ones eventuate in Australia as yet.
So dimensions are one issue. What type of energy requirements does a data centre need?
Yeah, so one of the important things is electricity. So all of these sort of thousands, sometimes tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of computer servers that are mounted up in these data centers require large amounts of energy to just run the computer chips within them. But also when they run, they generate large amounts of heat. And so electricity is also required to run cooling to keep data centers cool as well. And so a single data center can use anywhere from up to like the equivalent of 50 to 80,000 homes worth of electricity in Australia. But the other big issue is that all of this cooling that's required also uses potentially large amounts of water. And so a data center can use roughly the equivalent of something like 2,000 households worth of water as well. So that's another important consideration.
Okay, so energy, water. What are the expectations placed upon companies to uphold their obligations when building these centres?
Yeah, so that's interesting because the Australian government, just through their Department of Industry, Science and Resources, have just really been proactive and published a set of expectations for new data centres that are going to be developed. And they've got these five expectations, but two of them are relevant to our discussion here. And one of them is that they must support Australia's energy transition. So that must mean that means they should secure new and additional clean energy generation and include potentially some storage to offset demand as well and be energy efficient. And the is they should be sustainable and efficient with their water use. And so I think these are great initiatives, but the important point to notice is what the Australian government is saying is they're going to support data center proposals, prioritizing them based on how well they match these expectations. So they're not absolute requirements. They're just a way that the government will prioritize which data center development applications will get support. So so there is more and more of a, you know, push to try and embed sustainability and efficiency aspects in data centers, but it's still not an absolute requirement.
So we have these aspirations that they're sustainable, but we also really want them as a country, I'm assuming. Are we ambitious here in Australia about attracting and building data centers?
Yeah, we certainly are. So Australia's being very ambitious and looking at the research, it seems like Australia has the second largest pipeline of data center construction occurring in the world after the United States. So we've really got a bit of a boom of data center construction in Australia. And that's really been because the government, federal and state governments have been so keen to support data center development. And in Australia, we have Sydney and Melbourne being the locations with the largest number of data centers, but new data centers are being planned all around the country.
Do you have a sense of what the impact is on communities where a lot of these centers are being built?
Yeah, so, I mean, that varies a lot. We hear a lot of horror stories in the US, but I think in Australia, it hasn't been such an issue as yet. I mean, a lot of the data centers are going into areas that are earmarked for industrial development. There's concerns now that the data centers will be using electricity and water and potentially either constraining where urban development can occur or possibly driving up the prices of those utilities. But apart from that, we haven't heard stories of like huge amounts of noise affecting surrounding residents to the extent that we have in the US.
Mm. I've got a text from Kim who asks, is there a way to recycle the heat created by these centres back into usable energy?
Oh, that's a great question. And there's beautiful examples of other countries around the world where that's actually being done, where the heat from data centres, the hot water then gets piped and can be used to heat houses. And as far as I'm aware, there's nothing like that planned in Australia, but I think that's a brilliant idea, but it does require quite large infrastructure to make all of that happen, and that requires significant investment.
So there's this push from the government to kind of boost this industry. Are some councils pushing back against the rate of approvals or kind of approvals being granted in their areas?
Yeah, so that has definitely been the case. And we've seen that in both Melbourne and Sydney as well, and particularly with some councils recently in New South Wales in Sydney pushing back and writing about the fact that they want a halt or a pause, temporary pause in data center developments until we can understand better about the potential impacts on water and energy use. And I know in the west of Melbourne as well, there's been some concern in the water utilities and local councils as well about the impacts of the large number of data center applications that are being considered.
Look, on this, on that point about councils, mostly in cities, I've got this text which asks, do data centres have to be near big cities or can they be located in rural areas? And I'm thinking, you know, way out in kind of in sort of remote and rural areas even.
Yeah, well, that's another really good point. And I guess the answer really is depends on what the data center is used for. So some of the data centers that are going to be processing and like streaming data and require really low latency, meaning people can have really fast responses from the software running on the data centers, they're required to have a really good internet connection. And generally, that's required to have them located sort of closer to cities to achieve that. But some data centers now are being set up basically just for training AI models. And so that sort of thing is more similar to a type of offline activity. And so for data centers that are primarily doing those types of things, definitely there's the potential for them to be located further out in rural or regional areas, provided there's access to appropriate water and power.
Do these data centres create a lot of jobs? Presumably there are jobs in the construction, but once these servers are all set up and everything's humming along, I mean, is it attractive for a local council to have these centres because are they creating jobs for the locals?
Yeah, I think that's quite a valid point. And that criticism has been raised a lot because, as you say, while the data center construction is occurring, there may be thousands of people employed. But you're right, once a data center is established up and running, it can often just be like 50 or 20 people employed to just manage that data center. And so that, in terms of local employment, that can really be low. And, you know, often these data centers will be owned and run by big multinational corporations as well.
So if you're a local council, you might think better to attract a different kind of industry, which will bring more people and better jobs into the community.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. And if you're just looking at total number of people employed, that could definitely be a consideration.
You're listening to Life Matters on Radio National. I'm Damien Carrick, and we're talking about AI data centres. Do people know enough about data centres before they start appearing in their community? What's the consultation process like when these proposals are put forward?
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, currently I think, you know, awareness is raising about data centers and the impacts now because I feel like up until recently, people haven't had a big awareness of the potential impact of these data centers. But it's really just the last few years with the huge explosion in popularity of AI and all of these new data centers either starting to be built or being proposed and in the pipeline, that there's now a greater awareness of the potential impacts. But yeah, while local councils are really onto this and raising their concerns, I feel like there's still scope for local community to actually better understand the potential impacts of these data centers in their regions as well. But as I mentioned, usually they're constrained to only go into areas zoned for industrial types land uses. So it's not like they're going to be placed just totally in the middle of suburbia. But of course, there will be areas where, you know, suburbia butts up against these industrial land use zones. And so I can imagine that's where there could be some problematic issues.
We have a text from Clyde. His question is, what are the security risks with data centres, e.g. someone decodes to target a data centre during a conflict? Is that an issue?
Yeah. Well, that's another. So there's multiple issues there. I mean, so one issue is securing the data centres themselves that are housed in Australia. And so that certainly is an important concern. And I know even for data centers that are running critical government services, often their locations are actually kept hidden. So people don't actually know where they are for that very purpose of keeping them secure. And of course, there's important requirements to have all of the software kept up to date and highly secure. But the other interesting thing is about this data sovereignty issue. Like, one useful thing is if we can have data centers constructed in Australia, storing data in Australia, that means when we're using products and software services running on those data centers, we know that our data is being kept in Australia and not being shipped off to some data center in the US or somewhere else in the world. So from that perspective, it can also be quite beneficial for having data centers that are running and storing data here in Australia.
And look, one of the requirements, I mean, we've been talking about the problems with data centers, but is it possible that maybe if there's a requirement that they become responsible and even a source of renewable power, that would actually help our transition towards renewable energy?
Well, that's right. So there can definitely be ways that increasing data centres in Australia can support transition to renewable energy. And that's particularly if the data centres commit to supporting sort of new renewable generation rather than just consuming existing power supply, some of which may be coal-fired. So if data centres can invest in renewable projects by, you know, establishing contracts with guarantees to provide, to purchase certain amounts of renewable power every year, that can really de-risk and support clean energy project investment. So that can be really useful. And I guess other things that have been pointed out is that data centers can be co-located with large battery storage, and that can help manage peak loads and reduce strain on the grid as well. So they can actually, if set up correctly, help stabilize the electrical system during peak demand. And that can prevent the need for bringing on like gas-powered or fossil fuel-powered energy backups to manage peaks.
So we need to do the thinking and the planning to make the most of this new opportunity. Dr. Aslan Gordon, Senior Lecturer in Sustainability and Urban Studies at RMIT, thank you so much for speaking to Life Matters.
You're welcome. Thanks, Damien.
In just a moment, Artemis 2 has just sent astronauts further from Earth than any mission since Apollo. But beyond the milestone, what does it mean for those of us back here on Earth? Is it worth the billions of dollars amid the challenges that we're all facing closer to home?
Ready? Yeah.
Little listeners have a brand new space on the ABC Listen app to get all their favourite podcasts. Okay. Head to the Kids tab to create a custom kids profile just for them.
Amazing!
Dino Dome, Imagine This, The Dougie Pupcast, and lots more.
Please, come in.
Plus, they'll get exclusive access to new episodes of the Bluey Listen Along podcast.
Hooray! Let's dance to celebrate!
Create a kids profile today on the ABC Listen app.
It's official. The Artemis 2 crew have travelled further from Earth than any humans before them, surpassing the record set more than 50 years ago during Apollo 13. It's a huge moment for space exploration. We've got a first real look at the far side of the moon. History is happening and you know, it's thrilling, right? And yet, if I'm completely honest, I'm also sitting here thinking, I know it's a big deal. I know the visuals are amazing, but I'm not sure entirely why. What exactly are we hoping to learn from Artemis 2? And why does going just a bit further, well, in space terms, than we did back in the 1970s, why does that matter now? And what does this mission actually unlock for future space exploration? I'm no astronaut, but lucky for you, we have an expert in the house today. So if you've got a burning ambition or question, well, ambition to be an astronaut or question about space, you can text in on 0418 226 576, 0418 226 576. Enrico Palermo is the head of the Australian Space Agency, and he joins me here on Life Matters. Enrico, this is the first time we've sent humans on a lunar mission since 1970. How significant is that?
Yeah, good morning, Damien. I think, as you said, it is thrilling. Many of the world did not see the Apollo missions, and this is the first time since 1972 we have sent humans out into deep space. And I think this is a moment to be celebrated and, importantly, part of a vision not just to return to the moon, but do so on a sustainable and repeatable basis.
50 years seems like a long time between visits. Why has it taken so long to send another mission towards and around the moon?
I mean, a lot has happened in space exploration, space science in the last 50 years. We had the space shuttle era. We had the building of the International Space Station, which has now had more than 25 years of continuous human presence in low Earth orbit. We've seen robotic exploration of Mars and other parts of the solar system. And here on Earth, we have seen space technologies really woven through the fabric of our economy, our security, and understanding our planet. And so although we haven't gone back to the moon in the last 50 years, a lot has been happening in space.
And this, we should stress that it's not a landing on the moon, it's a flyby. Essentially, it's a test flight to put the Orion spacecraft through its paces. Is that the key purpose, to prepare us for further engagement with this part of the moon, not part of the world?
That's right. Artemis 2 is the next step in a test flight program designed to NASA to return humans to the surface of the moon. So this flight has seen many firsts. It's the first time the space launch system with the Orion capsules has humans on board. So as you can imagine, they're testing the life support systems that keep the astronauts safe. They're testing navigation and communication systems. They've tested docking procedures, which will be a requirement for future lunar landings. And so all elements of this flight are testing the systems, running experiments on the astronauts, really to understand how this can be done at a higher cadence, how it can be done safely and more routine in the future.
And we've been hearing a lot about the toilets, making sure that they will work and be functional if there are longer trips in the future.
That's right. Well, the Apollo capsule did not have a toilet, so this is the first space capsule of this kind to have a toilet. And you know, it's test flight, and all systems are going through their paces, and there'll be a lot of lessons learned that they'll bring back for the next iteration for sure.
So in addition to kind of testing this new spacecraft, what sorts of scientific research is happening on these missions? What are we learning about the moon?
Yeah, I mean, this is a science mission as much as a test flight mission. And I think there's sort of three areas I think about. The first is the astronauts are a key part of the experiment here. This is the first time humans have ventured past the Van Allen radiation belts into deep space since the 1970s. And if you think of the advances in our ability to understand the body, assess characteristics, you know, we're 50 years more advanced. And so the astronauts are being studied from wearing wearable technology to look at their sleep patterns, their stress, the circadian rhythms. There are tests to understand the impact on the radiation on their bodies, both wearable sensors, but also avatar cells, you know, avatar cells that are grown from the astronauts' own cells, to really reestablish baselines on the impact of deep space on the human body, and doing that with, you know, technology from this century. Additionally, there is quite a bit of geological work going on, and that was a particular focus during the flyby of the moon, looking at potential landing sites, studying lava tubes, lunar craters, and using the human eye, which still can really detect nuances in topography and colours, and other features that we don't get necessarily from the robotic missions that have been to the moon.
I'm fascinated by that, because you would assume that those photos taken by those robotic sort of spacecraft would come back with kind of, you know, photos which would be high resolution. But you're telling me that the human eye is more important. And why is that?
Well, the human eye, and also I was listening to the crew on the way to the moon yesterday, was actually having more than one human do those observations, and that ability to hypothesize and discuss with your fellow explorer are really important to how the science is done. And that was summarized well by the astronauts. But yeah, I mean, with the human eye ability to interpolate it, there's only so many features a robotic camera can catch. So it's an element of integrating sort of what the eye is seeing with scientists who are doing geology.
And what sorts of things are we learning through that process about the surface of the moon?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously we've got wonderful images that are they're coming back, and actually Australia's played a part in getting those images back at very high resolutions. I mean, the science will unfold for what they've covered. There's parts of the moon we haven't seen before on the far side, so this will give us a deeper understanding of potential opportunities and challenges for various future landing sites. Also looking at some of the newer craters, so how are craters that have formed more recently in the lunar history different from the sort of geological base. So there's a whole raft of geological science that will come out of this.
Mm. How does learning about the moon help us understand the lives of humans here on Earth, especially given all the challenges that we're currently facing? Is this a good place to park our resources?
Well, history has shown that when we go to space, firstly, the work to build the capsules, build the technologies happens here on Earth. Whether it's work NASA is doing or even Australian companies doing, that is about jobs, manufacturing, design work here on Earth. But what we know from when we go to space, it requires us to innovate for one of the harshest of environments. And so we result in explorations resulted in such a wide array of technologies, from water purification to fire retardant materials and insulation to cordless power tools to the camera on your mobile phone. So the spin-offs, it's really immeasurable the value space exploration has had on society. Secondly, to my point about the astronauts being an experiment, that is true also in the sense that when we're in a microgravity environment, the way fluids flow through our body, the way our muscles and bones work are different. And that allows us to study at an accelerated rate conditions such as bone and muscle loss, which has benefits to how we can treat and study effects such as osteoporosis through to cardiovascular effects from the heart changing shape and changes in how blood flows through the system has direct impact to treatments for cardiovascular issues here on Earth. And so the sort of a second leg is all the medical and pharmaceutical science that comes out from space flight. And the third is the fact is, we know so much about our planet from going to space. When we think about issues such as climate change and understanding how our planet is changing, more than 50% of the variables needed to understand the various climate models can only be measured from space. And if you look at the volume of data that's needed, it's more than 90% of that comes from space. So there's multiple layers to why going to space is a good investment, and the benefits ultimately are here back on Earth.
Enrico Palermo, head of the Australian Space Agency, thanks so much for speaking to Life Matters.
Thank you.
I've loved hearing from you this morning. Earlier we had a great conversation about navigating divorce with kids. So many text messages about how you've made it work. One text says, "Growing up kid of divorce here, my sister and I split our time between mum's house and dad's throughout our teen years. And my enduring memory of being a forgetful kid with two houses was the number of times I'd leave my shoes behind at the wrong house." Another text says, "We decided not to say the word divorce because the kids already had negative associations with it. We wanted them to feel like it was something different because it was something very unique to us. So we just told them that we were going to get two houses, but we were still a family and will always be. But we wanted to have more space between us, and that we would live close enough to each other so that we can always have access to them and they would always have access to us." Patrick texts in, "Bird nesting seems all well and good, but what about when a parent repairs?" Alana says, "Paying for three homes is beyond the financial situation of most people. It's important that kids are told that it's not their fault the relationship changes and that parents don't fight or talk bad about the other parent." That's all we have time for on Life Matters this morning. Tomorrow on the program, Dominic Sandbrook, co-host of The Rest Is History. He talks about his new podcast project, The Book Club, and his recent hot take that we're raising a post-literate generation. A huge thank you to the Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the week. And you can find all Life Matters episodes on ABC Listen. Just search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow, and you're all set. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.